Thanks, Bronwyn. Well, that gets us to the end of the prepared section of the day, and now it starts to become a lot more free-for-all. So what we're going to do is have a look at the issues that we've talked about so far and attempt to figure out what it is that we're going to work on today. And the first part of that is question and answers. Right now, you probably have a lot more questions bouncing around in your heads than you do answers from all of the presentations that you've heard today. What does this mean for me when you talk about statutory damages? How does that differ from regular damages? Are we still talking about DVD, region shifting being a problem? There might be any number of things like that. What does this mean? What about? Perhaps there's a perspective in the audience here that we haven't heard from that would nonetheless be useful and valid to hear from. So I'm going to turn this over to you now. This is your opportunity. This is your day. You are making this work. Participate and make it happen. Who will go first? Do we have any questions or any statements? Yes, sir. Fantastic. So would you mind identifying yourself just so we know?
Mark Blair, I'm an assistant analyst.
Thanks, Mark. So for those of you following along on the interwebs, the point was made that we should attempt to identify stakeholders so that we know not just the stakeholders for what we're attempting to do, but the stakeholders that have driven the agenda so far, and they are the ones who have had representation. We need to say who it is that we are addressing and who it is that we are talking to. Thank you, Mark. That was a good point. I think, from my perspective, what I've heard today so far from this has been there are content users, the rights of citizens generally, everybody who is the recipient of a copyrighted work, and there are the copyright holders, the people who create the works. There are distributors, the people to whom the right to that copyright has been licensed and who then create businesses out of that. There are intermediaries who are people like the ISPs or perhaps websites like YouTube, where infringement may take place, but it is not infringement by the institution organization that is running that intermediary. So I think those are a good stab at the parties. Are there any other parties that you can think of that I haven't been able to name? Fantastic. Any more questions, points, thoughts? So please state your name and then your question.
Hello. I'm still a random person. Not a question, just a sort of thought, really. I think that focus on three strikes is a bit of a red herring. I think it's focusing on punishment for something which, in the words of Lawrence Lessig, is quite simply insane. Copyright, as it stands at the moment, is completely unworkable, it's completely ridiculous, and I think that focusing on punishment is a red herring for what the real drive of this is, which is secondary liability. What it's about is putting frighteners on ISPs and application developers and so on and so on. So I think what we need to be looking at is whether or not the work once get paid forever model is a good thing. I don't think it is. And that's my thought. So thank you.
Thank you. Stephen.
Stephen Marshall, Victoria University, in a private capacity this time, though. I think while I agree with the fact that copyright's broken and there are all these big issues that we're conscious of and big risks, I think the worry is that if we just wrote a document that said, or ran arguments that just said, this is a bad idea, it's not good for us, that's not going to be necessarily very compelling in achieving an outcome that we desire. And the outcome we desire is to make this treaty go away, basically, or at least limit its scope dramatically. And the strategy that seems to be being used by groups like the US and Japan in this treaty is that they've got extremely valid issues. So serious problems with counterfeit goods being produced in a large scale to defraud and deceive people. Now, we've already got law about that. It's called passing off, but that's a separate issue. What they've managed to do, though, is have that and then link a whole lot of other things nebulously around it. And so it becomes a bit of a he said, she said about what their real agenda is. I think a stronger strategy would be to say, yes, we agree. Counterfeiting, misrepresentation is harmful. Let's focus on making sure that you have a treaty that just addresses those things. I think it was the point that Kim was essentially making. Trim the focus of the sucker right back to what it really should be addressing. Question why it is, for example, that they're defining intellectual property to include things like undisclosed information and geographical indicators and things like that. By pulling in all of the other forms of IP right at the beginning of this treaty, make the statements very much more specific. And other issues like, why are they talking about linking to things in this treaty? Why are those clauses in there at all? Draw people's attention to those things which are extending the scope of this treaty harmfully, with it, and have a clear strategy, not about arguing the wrongs and rights of international IP law, making this treaty be what it genuinely should be, because that's a strategy that negotiators can actually use.
So it sounded to me like what you're saying is we should, at the very minimum, have a strong statement of what a counterfeiting treaty would cover, and that we support the fight on fake medicines and mass-produced knockoff goods, but also resist the treaty's negotiators' attempt to expand the scope beyond physical counterfeit goods into the digital realm where things get messy. Michael has a rebuttal, and then we have a man at the back who'd like to speak as well. Michael, or a follow-on.
It's not so much a rebuttal, but actually, I mean, the point of trying to limit the scope to counterfeiting, I think, is a good one. And in fact, the European Parliament issued a resolution almost unanimously about 3-4 weeks ago, which one of the statements is to limit the treaty just to counterfeiting. And when asked about it, the lead European Commission negotiator has twice now essentially refused to abide by that resolution. And so there is a second part of the resolution that talks about copyright, and his argument is you have to read this resolution together, both that statement and the other copyright statement, and so it won't be pinned down just to limit to counterfeiting. But I think the strategy is a good one, and in fact it's exactly what some of the members of the European Parliament have tried to do.
Thank you. And gentleman at the back.
Hi. Ooh. Sorry, Peter Dengate Thrush.
Hot mic.
not used to standing up with a microphone. I wanted to begin by thanking Michael for spending time with us rather with your children on the weekend. Thank you very much for that. I have a question right back to the beginning for you. It's a follow-on, I think, to that first question. I'm here entirely in a private capacity, I suppose. I'm an IP lawyer based in Wellington. The question was, you know, who are the stakeholders behind this? I think a very good first question. The follow-up to that is, you know, we should know who we're dealing with. Why are the countries who have joined this country club doing so? What's in it for them, particularly if they are saying they don't need to change their laws? So is it just to get a friendly group together so they can go and tackle the Pakistans and the others that you mentioned are not inside the club? If that's what it is, let's find out why are they doing this, so if we're going to go and talk to them, we know what their objective is. And the second question really is directed at Jordan, who I thought gave an excellent summary of the crucial issue. If we remember that intellectual property rights are monopolies, and most of the law is opposed to monopolies, and the reason why the special exemption exists in relation to these monopolies is because they are in the public good. I think if you start from that point, as Jordan has done, you get a very clear idea of what the balance is that we need to achieve here. There has to be a balance in sustaining monopolies, which are normally a bad thing, because they are seen to be delivering a benefit. And if the balance changes by means of one of the crucial elements, such as the distribution chain, then it's perfectly legitimate to make sure that the balance gets adjusted somewhere else. The question for me as a lawyer is someone going to do what Kim seems to have done for Australia and go through and actually say, what are the changes to the law in New Zealand that this is going to lead to? Because the suggestions that it's going to criminalise trademarks at the border, we already have that. The suggestion that you can't go and get injunctions against secondary infringers and copyright, we already can do that. A lot of the things that people are worried about, to me, already seem at a very rough level to be in our law. You can't do it for patents. You can't get an injunction at the border to stop patent infringing goods, as far as I know, but you can for trademarks and other things. So it would be really helpful to me in analysing this and being helpful if I can, to know what actual changes to our law at a reasonably detailed level will be. So the question to Jordan is someone in the organisation actually doing a match-up against New Zealand IP provisions? Thanks.
If I could not to step on Jordan's toes, but just to mention that Section 92A is, of course, in process at the moment, and that has included things like and does include currently things like internet termination as a penalty. If things do emerge in the Act of negotiations that require change of law in New Zealand, then that could see changes to Section 92A taking place later on down the track, or at this moment anyway.
Mm-hmm. Just briefly, Peter, we do need that. It isn't underway yet, but we'll probably do it. The complications are the copyright infringing file sharing bill, which may yet change, and the fact that we've only got leaked texts from January. Maybe one of the Europeans will be kind enough to leak the text that's going into this round quite shortly, and then we will have something better to work on. But I think even if we just followed the template that Kim has already helpfully done for Australia and gave it to a lawyer and said, do this for NZ, that would be quite helpful, and I'm going to look at that next week. On the broader issue that was raised by the earlier ones, if I can just take advantage of having the mic, it's a classic political economy problem where a well-organised small group with a lot to lose and lots of money from what it might lose is prosecuting a case through a US trade negotiation system that has some particular characteristics. And Bill Patry from Google has had some interesting things to say about this at a seminar I saw, and that's in his book, The Copyright Wars, where basically the United States Trade Representative Office has good links in with content-producing industries and not-so-good links with platform-providing industries, as a gross simplification. And so U.S. sees IP protection strengthening as a key way to protect its own export industries. And given the magnetic desire apparent by many people to have a free trade agreement with the United States, that provides leverage. And I think the other point that John might make is that what this does is it starts to raise global norms for IP enforcement. If they start up with a group of countries who are prepared to give way on that for whatever reason, they will then attempt to propagate that out more broadly around the world over time.
Thanks, Jordan.
My name's Alec Wilson. I'm an independent management consultant. I'd like to bring in a slightly different focus to this and suggest that New Zealand should not support any agreement which disadvantages New Zealand compared with the major countries in the world, and particularly the United States. Now, I'd like to, extend Bronwyn's comments on TPM and zoning. If we were to adopt the ACTA, then TPM becomes a greater problem than it is now, and it puts New Zealand consumers and businesses at a disadvantage because some materials that are available in the United States will not be available or usable in New Zealand.
Thank you. Michael, I think you had something to...
To respond to Peter's question, and actually the Europeans did leak a more up-to-date version, given that you're asking for it. There's actually two leaks.
Now, that's great service.
There's the leak text that's consolidated to January. There's also a table that's been released that actually is post-Guadalajara. So if you combine the two, you'd actually get an up-to-date version. They haven't leaked the consolidated version that they developed internally a couple of weeks ago. But Peter asked the question about sort of who's behind it and what's the motivation with the countries. And this is sort of just my own opinion on this, is we can divide up the ACTA partner country, ACTA negotiating countries into three different groups. There are those that are active proponents of it, as primarily the United States, the European Union, and I guess Japan. Then there are those who are there because they see it as relatively costless, because it's probably pretty consistent with what their existing laws are, largely through trade agreements like Australia, Morocco. I mean, if you want, why is Morocco in this? It's because they already have a trade agreement, and this is easy. And the U.S. likes them in there because the ratification number that they've put forward is 5. And so once they get a final agreement, it'll be very helpful to reach that number of 5 to make this an effective treaty by having countries like Morocco on board who can say that we're on side because they've already agreed to all of this through a trade agreement. And then there are a few countries who are basically there to play defense. It's not that they're crazy about it, but they're there because they recognize this will require change, and they want to limit that as much as possible. And Canada and New Zealand, I think, are the two most obvious countries there that would require the most amount of change amongst the active negotiating partners. Now, why is all this taking place? To me, this is just an obvious continuation of U.S. trade policy, which for the last 15 years has been very focused on incorporating IP provisions into trade agreements, but it's somewhat inconvenient if you're doing it country by country by country. It takes time to negotiate it in Australia or Singapore or elsewhere. Far better to create what is now an international standard, and then, or attempt to be an international standard, and then use that with other countries that haven't yet met that standard. I mean, I don't think anybody hides the fact that this is just trade policy. This is an attempt to almost meta trade policy by taking what was typically done on a country by country basis, create a new document that can then be used with large number of other countries, and not even have to get into the hassle of negotiating by saying this has already been agreed to. This is what you have to meet if we're going to have a trade agreement down the road.
Thank you. So to return to the earlier point of Alex, which was he feels that New Zealand should not support an agreement which disadvantages New Zealand relative to the US. And I'm going to put on my ESP hat here, and I am channeling the New Zealand negotiators who say that we are creating advantages for New Zealand exporters of IP. That would probably be their response to that point, which... Alec has a response to Don, and then we'll move back to Alec. Don?
Just two things. One, I can confirm you're challenging. That's exactly what they say. And they say that every exporter is exporting IP, so it's a massive industry. They don't need to measure it. Just on the legal changes, if you are doing analysis, can I suggest that we analyse changes to legislation that has taken place since 2004? I still have... the firm belief, given that certainly in New Zealand, the same people negotiating ACTA on our behalf have also been involved in drafting copyright and patent legislation, that there's a strong tie between those two things. So whilst legislation might have been passed in a preemptive manner, we should measure how that matches up to the provisions that we see coming through now in ACTA. So those claims of no legislation needs to change are kind of bullshit. So...
Excellent. The first swear word was not said by me. I'm very happy about this. Alec, would you, and then welcome other hands as well, plenty of people we haven't heard from.
Nat, I hear what you say as comment from the New Zealand negotiators. I have to say that I have to reject the argument that they put forward unless they also count the cost to the New Zealand consumers of the non-availability of media that is not being released in New Zealand. Now, I know people, people close to me, who download stuff from the internet, probably illegally, almost certainly illegally, not because they won't pay for it, because it's not available in New Zealand. And I suggest that there is no economic loss to the rights holders if they refuse to make material available in New Zealand for purchase at retail. I believe these aspects need to be considered and balanced against the position that the New Zealand negotiators are taking.
Thank you. Kim has a point to make here.
Just a very quick response, which is that can actually be an extremely effective argument. I mean, we saw this when we were implementing the FTA with the United States and Australia. The one exception that we wrote into anti-circumvention laws, arguably contrary to the FTA, was one that was supposed to allow circumvention of region-coded DVDs because of that argument that there was material that wasn't being made available in Australia and people should have access to that. So it does actually have some traction. It's worth mentioning.
Thank you. Other hands, plenty of people who we haven't heard from. Yes, down the front.
Jim Whitman, I'm here in my own right, I guess. One of the things that strikes me about the discussion about ACTA is that at times it concentrates upon the rule of law, and rightly so. That's only one of a number of ways in which we make things work in society, including the law itself. And I guess I picked up on your mention of customs, for instance, and what in fact really is policing and regulation, I guess, which is another tier to the question of legislative fair business. And I guess I think it's right to concentrate on the law as it might become, but at the same time I think we should really look at other necessary aspects for making copyright work, or whatever it is that around intellectual property. And it struck me quite forcefully when looking at the question of surveillance, search and surveillance, and the extent of the powers in which regulators and policing bodies are given to deal wholesale with questions of infringement or wrongdoing. But that, again, it tends to forget the fact that we're in a deregulated economic climate, and it's been running and increasing for a long while. Recourse to regulation is quite difficult. There is a problem about capture for regulators, but nonetheless there are ways of working with this. But I think a feature of the campaign should tackle some of the broader economic changes, the economic style of government.
So if I can...
No problem.
So if I can summarise then that you were saying that ACTRA is concentrating, as it's written at the moment, concentrating on one part of the many legs upon which our society stands, the enforcement of the law, whereas changing the law itself, but also the changing economic climate and whether we are pro or con regulation and regulation of industries is also an important thing that we might want to put in there. Perhaps a statement about how we are moving as a society towards less regulation and this seems to represent stronger and more onerous regulation. Would that be an appropriate summary? Fantastic.
Yeah, get power to the state back again in many respects. I'm sorry, that's an add-on. But I think the state should become more powerful.
The state should become more powerful?
Yeah, in support of democracy and the law, in fact.
Okay, thank you.
Tēnō koutou katoa. Ko Daniel Stripe tōku ingoa. He mihi nui ki te tangata whenua, ki te whare nei. Greetings to you all. Great to see you all here. My name's Daniel Stripe. I'm an information freedom activist. I've been involved in setting up things like the Aotearoa Indie Media News Service and also involved in the Creative Commons Aotearoa New Zealand project. I'd like to address what this gentleman over here said about stakeholders. I think that's a really interesting and an important point. And one of the key groups of stakeholders in relation to ACTA is groups like the Recording Industry Association of America, the Motion Picture Association of America, our own RIANZ, the content creation groups. Now, we have to keep in mind that... parties to these associations are corporations, and for anyone who's seen the documentary The Corporation, you'll know that the legal DNA of a corporation obliges it to do everything within its power to serve the bottom line of its shareholders, regardless of the public interest, regardless of the public good, regardless of what's fair or reasonable. If ACTA is potentially something that's going to make them more money or reduce perceived losses, then they will push it with every means at their disposal. You can't negotiate with that because you're not dealing with something that's actually rational. So the situation we're in is we're hoping to have government, the state, regulators protect us from the desire of corporations to maximise their bottom line at any cost by creating a legal environment in which corporations have to respect things like human rights and civil liberties.
So that would be the positive affirmation of what you're saying then, is that the declaration should include something that says we expect ACTA to take account of human rights and civil liberties and include the things that perhaps haven't been present so far.
And fantastic. Particularly that those things are more important than the perceived right of corporations to make more money.
My name's Andrew Cushion. I'm a telco guy. I work for Vodafone. I am here in my own private capacity, though, which I think I should highlight. A couple of contrary points from me, just mainly because I get off on playing devil's advocate, perhaps. The first thought that I have is around those rights arguments, and I think that there needs to be a recognition here that rights, that people that create content do have a right to restrict and encumber how that content is used. Yeah, it may be crazy that they want to take that right to limit the way that people can use their products, but nevertheless, that is the right that some content holders, some content creators, should have. Now, your response as a consumer to that is not to consume that product. You have the right not to use those contents that are so encumbered. You don't have the right to circumvent that content creator's decision to restrict access, though. And I think that that's an important consideration that I want to put out there. The second point that I wanted to make is that this is an international problem. Content creation and content infringement, by the nature of the internet, means that US content will be infringed all around the world. I argue that you do need to have an ACTA-like treaty in order to deal with that. You do need to look internationally in order to solve that problem, and you do need to look for common standards of enforcement around the world. Is it necessarily an evil thing that these people are sitting together and negotiating this together, when in actual fact they are trying to find common standard solutions to what is an international problem? So as I said, I recognise that these arguments may not necessarily be popular. I am deliberately playing devil's advocate here, but I think we need to ground ourselves in some of these key facts about this argument.
Sure, thank you. And I saw Matthew's hand shoot up the instant that you said something.
Yeah, just to respond to a couple of points that have already been said. With regard to the idea that people can protect their artistic works and then consumers can choose not to buy it, sort of the free market approach to this kind of thing, I'd like to say that copyright isn't just based on contract law. It's not just based on the idea that you have nothing and then you initially start negotiating whether or not you're going to get rights to something. The idea is that for low-value transactions, for example, to buy a single, like a music single, that might be, say, $10 if you were to buy a CD, or much cheaper online, of course. If you were to do this and then get out the lawyers to try and negotiate, of course, there's no way that transaction would ever occur. So for low-value transactions, it's actually essential that the public are able to have some certain rights. Sorry, I just need to actually feed the baby here. So I'd say that even for economic reasons, it's essential that the public have a lot of rights to encourage them to engage in more commerce, and that it's not merely a matter of contract law, which is something that copyright should never become. It should always be around that kind of balance between public and private rights. To an earlier point there about termination being a red herring, I think that termination is a very tangible thing for a lot of New Zealanders, and so as a way of bringing about the discussion, I think it's an excellent point to bring up. So in that respect, I think we should bring up termination, the idea of medicine and medicinal patents and stuff like that being possibly considered infringing in New Zealand, and these kinds of issues as a way of engaging the public. Termination, I certainly do not think, is a red herring issue to bring up.
Thanks, Matthew. Down here.
Hi, my name's Chris Bull. I'm a musician, web developer, and wannabe entrepreneur. I've got three points. First of all, back to your point. You were talking about how we should have restrictions on copyrighted goods and all that, and you know, in the interest of protecting consumers. The problem is we have this thing called the internet, and it doesn't really allow for that without making the experience worse. And I think that a number of artists and a number of my contemporaries in a lot of ways have proved that you can have freedom of information on the internet and still make money. But, of course, within CD piracy and, you know, selling pirated CDs at a shop, that's a slightly different argument. But the nature of the internet actually doesn't lend itself at all, really, to that sort of protection. The second thing I want to make is I think it should take into account, as I was speaking to a couple of people about in the break, about the idea of if you're a website that hosts content, you can be liable. And especially I was talking to someone from Trade Me, and I'm currently building a website that will have a similar type of situation, and we could be liable for, you know, just simple user-generated content, which is a really important provision that we shouldn't be liable for, really. I mean, unless it's obviously terribly. And finally, where do Creative Commons licenses fit within the ACTA framework and the enforcement? And how would, if, you know, would a musician who licenses their music under Creative Commons, how would an ISP know that that was licensed that way? And what sort of bureaucracy is going to have to be created to keep track of what's Creative Commons and what isn't? Yeah.
Thank you. Gentleman with his hand up there was...
My name's John Rankin. I think I want to ask a question because I heard Stephen quite correctly say that we agree there is an issue with counterfeiting physical goods, such as handbags, medicines, and it would be great if the treaty were restricted to what its title is. It's about anti-counterfeiting. Jordan has... I think I really want to reiterate Jordan's question. If the scope is broader than counterfeiting, what exactly is the international problem that the treaty is intending to solve? So I would like to see anything that comes out of today, if it is going to have a broader scope than anti-counterfeiting, a clear statement of what the problem is that this broader scope is addressing, and a more accurate title. Because if it's not just an anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, then it should not be called an anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. Thank you.
Stephen? And then Roz.
I just wanted to... Sorry, Stephen.
Wrong
Marshall.
Stephen. That's all right, let's trade Stephens. Let's bounce through the Stephens.
Stephen Bell. Bell, once again, as a private citizen, not as a reporter for Computer World, I wonder, I hesitate to further enlarge a very complex discussion, but I wonder if there's any way of taking into account the fact that New Zealand is involved in free trade agreement negotiations at the moment. And my worry, and the worry of some other people, is that concessions might be made on ACTA in the cause of getting a better free trade agreement, as somebody expressed it, sacrificing provisions for our creative industries in the cause of selling more milk powder.
Ram for lamb, you might say.
So is there a way of... I'd like to see some statement made on this. When I've spoken to the ACTA negotiators, they've said... we're in an ACTA bubble. We have no view of this. I'd like this discussion not to be completely in the same bubble.
And yet the 92A discussion paper said that, mentioned ACTA, I think, by name.
Yeah. There was Roz. You need to give the microphone to Roz back there. And thank you. Sorry, Stephen. You're too slow.
Hi everyone, Roz Coote, public servant here in my own right. I'd just like to bring into the conversation Colin Jackson's submission on the ACTA draft. Was his view was that the people who were working on ACTA didn't seem to understand the internet and they were trying to regulate it. And I think that's a very real danger that we're moving into here, is that an old pre-internet industry is trying to regulate the internet industry. And we need to, I would support the moves to move the ACTA treaty back to being about counterfeiting of physical goods. Thank you.
Thanks, Rose.
Just responding to the devil's advocate, I think he's raised a really, really important issue that we should advocate that the Act, or the agreement rather, respect cultural differences. Rather than having uniform standards across the world, you know, different penalties and punishments have different meanings in different cultures and different countries, and those really need to be respected.
Thank you. Stephen, and then gentleman at the back.
This time I think it is me. So I just wanted to make two comments. First one is in response to the other Stephen's point about the trade negotiations. I think there seems to be this idea floating around in government that I think needs to be challenged, which is that if we do the right thing, then the Americans will let us have good access to their markets. It's like, hang on. No, it clearly doesn't work. We need to be running the argument that we need to protect as much as possible anything the Americans might want on the basis that we can grudgingly give them up in small drips and drabs when it allows us to sell them more milk powder or kiwi fruit or whatever. This idea that we do it preemptively and then they'll do the right thing is naive. Second point, I wanted to talk about the devil's advocate comment, which I think is taken in the spirit it was given, I think. It's buying into this argument that the owners of encumbered rights have absolute power. That absolutely must be challenged in this document. Free societies depend inherently on our ability to take anything that exists and comment upon it. We're not talking here about satire and entertainment. We're talking here about the ability to hold powerful people, organisations accountable for the damage that they do to our own societies. If we allow laws like this to introduce the rights around non-disclosed information and things like that, we're legislating the ability to protect vested interests. Take a very quick example here, something like the Toyota crisis in the US currently, where it's turning out from emails that Toyota well knew that there were problems with their cars that were putting people's lives at risk. If undisclosed information is absolutely protected under law, they could prohibit anybody ever talking about those emails in any situation, even while they're trying to be prosecuted. Another example, under US law, medicines derived from indigenous knowledge in other countries. Those countries lose the ability to have their own control of indigenous knowledge and other things like that because somebody else has redefined a law in their environment to enable them to make a quick buck. And by being involved in a treaty like this, that club that has become part of this are in fact legislating each other that will all agree to screw the people who aren't part of this agreement. Apologies for the language.
Gentlemen at the back. First, Jordan, did you have something that you wanted to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to... I think, Andrew, you've raised an important point about... And one of the things that serves me most about this discussion is the concept of intellectual property. It serves me in the same way that the use of the term piracy does, because property is a bad metaphor. When you own something, like my pen, if you take my pen off me, I don't have my pen anymore. And clearly it's my pen, I can decide what happens to it. Copyright is not a property right. It is a balance of rights for creators and for users. So actually, no, you don't have the right to wrap your product up in a TPM that stops me doing something that the law says I can do. That's an important point to make. The issue, big issue with TPMs that I have, is where they prevent lawful use. And the problem with enforcement, if enforcement didn't actually have any substantive impact on the real rights people have, I'd be really relaxed about a global code for it. But they are related. The way we enforce the law has a real impact on what the actual substantive rights are. So if you want to globalize enforcement, then the logical follow-on is, well, you're going to have to globalize the rights as well. And isn't it interesting that this treaty doesn't talk about globalizing the rights, it only talks about globalizing the enforcement, because it's about tilting the balance away from the public interest.
The US has been extremely effective in exporting the punitive portions of its copyright law and remarkably ineffective in exporting the good bits. I'm sorry, we had a comment back
there. Yeah, Peter Coronius. I represent the Internet Industry Association in Australia. I want to make a point about this question of the role of intermediaries. I think that it's important that if we are to produce a declaration, we should address this very critical role that intermediaries have played historically in the development of the Internet. I get a little bit concerned with the focus on termination, as if under the three strikes proposal. I'm concerned that if we confine ourselves to that question, maybe we concede that there are other roles that intermediaries ought to play here, such as notice and notice. And I think, as Kim points out in her paper, it's certainly a matter that we've raised even in our submissions in the IINet case last year, that putting any obligation on intermediaries to enforce third-party rights is a cost upon those intermediaries that, from a conceptual level, they ought not properly bear. And so I think if we're going to frame any statement around three strikes, it should be cast much broader than that, around the in principle position of intermediaries and how, because it may well be that this is an ambit claim. We know that when talking to the MPAA, they sought to differentiate themselves from those terrible people in the music industry that were seeking to cut people off the internet. We don't want to do that, they said. In fact, we're looking for any reasonable measure that intermediaries could take short of termination. And so I think we have to be very mindful of the fact that the end game here may not actually be termination, and it would be sufficiently bad if the end game was these other measures to, I think in the language of the leaked draft, to address infringement. You know, that address is a very nebulous concept, and I think we have to be careful to frame our response in terms of what address could encompass and put the responsibility back where it properly rests.
Thank you. So let me try to summarise the things that I've heard so far this morning. We will break for lunch when I'm done, and when we return, you'll have the tricky, difficult and tricky challenge of digesting the information that we've heard this morning and trying to pull apart the key issues. Here's some of the issues that I've heard so far. I think I've managed to reduce 4 or 5 pages worth of notes down onto one list of things. And so we should start, it was said, one possible area is to talk about what is the goal of ACTA? It's not clearly defined anywhere. And without a clear definition of the problem it is trying to solve, you'll never know whether it's succeeding in solving that problem. So the first thing would seem to be to get that goal. Is it purely purely directed at counterfeiting of physical goods? And if it's supposed to touch the digital world and the online world, then perhaps it's time that we said something about making it a law that is internet-wise. There were issues of transparency raised, the fact that we need participation of users and intermediaries, which brings in the wider concept of the public good that copyright is intended to serve, as Peter pointed out. That within that, we need to talk about fair use. Perhaps there's an... we could recommend that we enshrine the fair use exemptions. Perhaps there's room to strengthen the fair use here, export some of that good stuff around the world. That's in relationship not just to technical protection measures, the DRM, the ability digitally to stop you doing things with digital goods that you can do with physical goods, but also to spread beyond that into the other areas that that ACTA covers. So, for example, we talked about three strikes, and perhaps we would say, as one of our principles here, that we opposed three strikes. Or perhaps we would affirmatively say that we believe that everybody has a right to connect and that this right should not be trivially removed. Camcording was raised as one possible area to pay attention to. We talked about the administrative creep that happens here, where you begin saying, "Oh no, I'm purely addressing matters of enforcement. We're not attempting to change your law substantially, but in fact, it reveals that all of these things are excessive in the changes required to the law." We talked about damages and the fact that there's a possibility that ACTA might enshrine a calculation of damages with little thought, apparently, as to how that calculation comes about. We've seen extremely questionable numbers bandied around by music industry representatives as to the quantifying the damages of the loss caused by online copying, which is, you know, as we can see, reflected in the lower sales of albums. Oh, I'm sorry. No, there aren't lower sales of albums. Oh, dear. So there's extremely bogus numbers being bandied around, and we run the risk of having those enshrined in ACTA. We talked about the role of intermediaries in particular, that perhaps we would want to ensure that they had a voice. Perhaps we want to... So this is... Intermediaries are not just ISPs, but are websites as well. I know we have representatives of some of the websites here in the audience. Perhaps we want to enshrine common carrier status or something along those lines, where if you carry things from A to B without caring what they are, perhaps you shouldn't be held liable for those things. Non-commercial came up again several times as a particularly thorny issue. Some see it as a solution, that actors should be limited to non-commercial works. I'm questioning how useful... actors should be limited to commercial infringement only, and there should be holes carved in it for non-commercial infringement. There's an enormous question, though, as Kim raised, as to what that boundary between commercial and non-commercial is. And Creative Commons have struggled to define that. They're in the middle of a large process to figure out exactly what non-commercial means for them. So I think we'd be bold if we could claim that we'd be able to define that. But that is one of the challenges of that kind of claim. We talked about the fact that it is creating an institution that has the potential to supplant existing, more well-understood institutions that at least have some measure of participation and openness in them. We were talking about how perhaps we would want to focus actor negotiators more on what they're not doing in respect of the original counterfeiting problem of physical goods and medicine. And then finally, we talked about the need perhaps to have local flexibilities. So that is to say, the nations that are participating in the ACTA negotiations all have different copyright regimes. They differ on what freedoms they allow users, on exactly which things are covered by which parts of their copyright law. They differ on not just the quantity of penalties, but which things incur which penalties. And they differ, most importantly, philosophically, in which countries disagree as to whether they talk about the rights of users as on a peer with the rights of content creators, or whether the rights of users are actually negative rights for the content creators. You don't have the right to do this to users. That's an important distinction, one that colours the rest of the enforcement and institutional regimes around copyright, but one that ACTA perhaps will get rid of. So local flexibilities is something that we might want to think about there. And I'm sure that you'll be able to think of many more as you go away and talk with your fellow attendees here at lunch. And we'll be checking the website for suggestions as well from other people. When we return, and we'll be returning at 1:10, you'll work at your tables to identify the key issues that you think we should write about. So I've given you some ideas based on this morning's discussion, but I'm sure you'll be able to come up with many more when you talk with your friends. Please do write those down for us, and we'll report back at about 2:20 on those and figure out where each group got to. Just before lunch, I'd like to thank CityNet. If you have a laptop here and you are connected to the wireless, you would be using one of their little flyers with the code on. They've generously given this to us. If you're here with a laptop and you're not connected to the internet, you need to go to the registration desk and get a flyer with a code on it. Okay, thank you very much for your patience and your attention. Have lunch.